Il-program li ser tisimaw huwa miġjub lilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.
Welcome to University Matters on Campus FM. This is Patricia Camilleri, inviting you to discover what research, projects and events are taking place at the University of Malta. I'm very happy to have with me in the studio today Dr. John Consiglio. Just a few words, as usual, about my guest. After a 42-year professional banking career, during which I'd say he never stopped studying, he has been teaching at the university for the past 15 years, mainly in the Department of Banking and Finance of FEMA, MEDAC, which is the Mediterranean Academy of Diplomatic Studies, and what was EDRC,
European Documentation Research
Centre, which is now the Institute for European Studies, and also IPES, which is the Institute for Physical Education and Sport. His degrees are in the areas of banking, financial service management, law and accountancy. And his PhD thesis was a breakthrough study on the privatization of financial services in the Central and Eastern European countries. Dr. Consiglio is an avid researcher and has published some 6 books on the banking history of Malta and the Mediterranean. He's a former president of the Malta Center of the Institute for Financial Services and for over 12 years was chairman of the National Income Tax Appeals Board, a quasi-judicial national body. He was also the honorary treasurer of the Conservatorio Vincenzo Bugeia, which is probably Malta's oldest charitable foundation. And now, coming up to a young 75, he still loves his teaching, research, and generally being with young people, which is always such a joy. However, he also has a real admiration for the high sense of commitment that he always notes in the older, mature students.
That's true.
So I'm sure we'll hear a little bit more about that. Welcome, Dr. Consiglio.
Thank you, Patricia.
So you give lectures in 3 main areas at the moment, which are banking regulation, international economics, and
economics of sport.
Perhaps we could look at a little bit at each of those in turn. Let's start with the banking regulations. These are created by governments to subject banks to certain requirements and restrictions and guidelines. These regulations, of course, have come under very tight scrutiny these last years, so I'm sure there's a lot to sort of say about that.
The thing is that very often we tend to focus on what is happening on a day-to-day basis. That is what makes the news in the papers. But as a subject, as a discipline, banking regulation also has what I would call the, it's not static, but the important basic framework, which, amongst others, kicks off from the notion of the reality of the rule of law and the reality that what we have all around us is a constant process of re-regulation. As an old theory, well, old in terms of its original conception, in that it even goes back to Hegel's times, you know, the theory of thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. And re-regulation is basing itself on that, and as developed by an American guru, Edward Cain, argues that what we really have around us, as I said, is a constant process of you have regulators and you have the regulatees or the regulated at the bottom who, once the regulation is in place, go into a process which we call regulatory capture, where they learn to live with the regulation, work around it. Don't forget that these are the people in the market. They have to live with their own wits. Adapt themselves, and sometimes they manage to work themselves or the regulation to a point where it almost becomes irrelevant. I say almost. I am almost, because if the people at the top are conscious of what is happening, of regulatory capture process, what they should really be doing is what most of the time we read that they are doing. That is, they re-regulate. And so this is why we, no sooner do we go out of an announced structure that, and I'm not saying anything about the fact that the environment, particularly the economic environment, the market environment, is always constantly throwing up new situations, very often they create a new environment almost themselves. So the market is both self-regulating, creative, and regulated. And it's a complex thing if you see, you know, the way it is structured.
What exactly are these regulations trying to do for the bank? We talk about, you know, giving economic freedom to banks. The more freedom, the better. I mean, there is a train of thought that says, you know, they should be very free.
Well,
what are they trying to do with these
regulations? Very often I try to look at who is making the regulation. The institutions, for which also include governments, in different countries, have to work with different foci. And this is where you get regulatory differences. Take a simple example, Malta and the United States. United States, you have many regulators. You have the Federal Reserve Bank, you have the various state reserve banks, you have the Office of the Controller of the Currency, you have the General Accounting Officers, and you have a plethora there. You have the FDIC, Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, and each one of these has its own conceptual background, its own underpinning regulation, its own patch, you know, its market of regulator, for regulating. And so there, each one of these focuses on its own little piece of the picture. If you then look at the Malta Financial Services Corporation, basically the MFSA has four very simple, straightforward foci, which are the customers, the economy, the international scenario, and the law. And the MFSA is probably better off in this respect, in that it is, first of all, the only regulator you have in the country at the moment, and it can, within a small environment, which is what we are, regulate in a better way. Our scenario lends itself, but that's not being totally fair to itself, but we also have to be fair to who is making the regulations. So our scenario is one with which I'm happier, of course.
What about the actual aims? That, like, we're looking at a requirement for transparency,
yes,
with regard to what they're doing very often amongst themselves, these
well,
banks.
Yes. I have here, for example, an article written way back in 1986 by Michael Moran from University of Manchester, where he posits various theories of regulation and changes in regulation. And Moran says that there are various theories, which are instrumental theories, cultural theories, administrative theories, and each of these creates its own philosophy for the existence of regulation. And one of the things which he says is that very often regulators, yes, do tend to be in place for their own sake rather than for the market's sake. And we have to be aware of that possibility. I don't think it is the case in Malta, but overseas we have certainly had situations where the accusation was made either at that point in time or later through people like myself, you know, academics working on what they were doing. One theory, for example, is that during the Great Depression in the United States, the Securities and Exchange Commission was simply created to make work for the regulators, not really for the vagaries of the market, as they were then not caring. So things like, as you rightly imply, transparency and the interests of the customers, they are there, they are needed, and it's part of the job of regulators to see that these people, these stakeholders, which are only one amongst many, let's not forget there are many stakeholders in the market. I mean, the customers are probably the bigger part. But then you have also creditors of the banks themselves, which could be other creditors and other banks lending to the banks. You could be, that could be the government has an interest in banks being well funded, well capitalized, and well administered. So it's the list of stakeholders is quite big, and the regulators do not have an easy job.
Do you think, before we move on to the next area of your work, do you think that trust in the banks now is picking up after the rather disastrous situation of the last few years?
It's you know, one, I'd rather look at this in this way. The banks do not exist in a vacuum. The banks exist in an economy. They are only one of the players in the economy. I have very fond memories of somebody who I consider as the guru of Maltese banking, is the late Louis Gallia. And Louis Gallia used to say, if anything is good for banking, it's good for the market. Or rather, if anything is good for banking, it's good for the economy. If anything is good for the economy, it's good for banking. So implicitly he was saying, yes, let's have strong banks, but we also need a strong economy. We need a strong economy because then the banks will benefit. But then again, who am I mentioning? Banks and the economy. And what is this economy? The economy is you and me, plus the big players, the industrialists, the investors, the importers, the exporters. There's many of us, you know, with our finger in the pudding. So we all need each other.
Exactly. And in fact, that's a very good point to move on with, because international economics, again, is another buzzword these last years, where people are realizing that we're all connected.
We are all connected.
Like globalization and
we're
all the rest
connected.
Of it. So what do you tell your students about international economics?
Oh, I give them a tool. Well, the group I teach is a group, as I said, mature students who follow the MEDAC, the Mediterranean Academy of Diplomatic Studies, 2 year. It's quite a long course. It's a 2 year evening course in international economics. They're all grown ups, mature students, very dedicated. None of them ever misses a lecture, or they will email you before that they're going to do it. So I enjoy working with them because they ask a lot of the relevant questions. Many of them already have a baggage of experience, working experience, which they bring to bear in the classroom for the benefit of all concerned, myself included. I learn from them. I have no hesitation in saying that. And the way I structured that course is that since some of them would not have had any basic training in microeconomics at all, I give them, let's say, the bigger part of the first year into basic microeconomics, and I only really get into the nitty-gritty of international economic issues, there are many, during the second year. And international economics is about a lot of subjects, things like population theories, things like trading, importation and exportation, things like the national income and gross domestic product, economic systems of management, you know, capitalism, socialism, social market economy, there's a lot of that, and market situations, monopoly, oligopoly, there's a lot to do there.
And one of the arguments that is being very much tossed around, I listen on the radio, I have absolutely no expertise in this area at all, but, you know, obviously one listens to the news, the idea of spending our way out of the crisis or not spending our way out of the crisis. What about that?
It's a knife with two edges, because when you spend, a government is investing. I mean, let's say, rather than use the word spending, is investing. Now, investing implies an outlay. And unless you have the wherewithal to initiate that outlay, then what do? You go and borrow. And when you go borrow, it means that you have to pay interest. Now, it's a toss-up between the rapidity of the return on your investment and the pressures which you have on you for that borrowing. You know, you have to service the borrowing, you have to pay interest all the time, regularly. So the way I always try to describe an economy is like a blown-up balloon. and a blown-up balloon, you know, tied at the top, so it's full of air. But if you press air somewhere along the way, elsewhere in the balloon, that finger pressure is being felt. There's nothing in economics which is totally good or totally bad. Everything has its effect. Now, the effect can be short-term, medium-term, or long-term. And this is what finance ministers are trying to do all the time. They are hampered by the fact that they very often are living in a time-constrained political cycle. I mean, you know, the first thing which any politician does the moment he gets into power, the first thing he starts thinking about is probably the next election 5 years down the road. If he's lost the election, it's the same thing. So they are hampered in the type of decisions which they take. They're by this time constraint. But they are taking decisions in both the short term, annual budgets, discussions, ministerial estimates and all that, against the reality, of making an investment now, which only renders money later. I don't think, or rather, that there are so many possibilities of investments which once made immediately start procuring a return. I don't think that, there's an old dictum by Keynes who said that in the long run we're all dead. But I would rather modify that. I say there's also a possibility that in the short run many of us can be dead. And right. Parts of the economy, if the wrong investment is made, or say take an investment which immediately places a big onus on the government for an outlay, and what's he going to do? Borrow to affect that investment, and where is the money going to come from?
It always fascinates me, this sort of globalized economy that we have now, that there'll be countries making decisions at a certain time according to a certain situation within their own country and sort of looking around at others. But then the situation may change so quickly that then they get caught out, probably.
Again, that is because, all right, I teach economics, but I realize that economics is not the only thing. Economics is not the only social science. There's other things like sociology and politics. And these all have an impact. I mean, it's enough for a political crisis to come up. I mean, places, let's take a simple example. Turkey at this point in time, there's a lot of arguing and fighting about whether it should persist with its now long drawn out attempt to become a member of the European Union. And many people there are beginning to think, hey, we're on a weak wicket here, and we're never going to join Europe. So what do? They start saying, we want all that we were hoping for during these many years that we have been discussing, we want them now. People say, no, sorry, you can't have them. And this is where you start having civil unrest, strikes, riots, civil commotions and all that. Again, another example is the case of the Ukraine. The Ukraine, you know, it's now a big civil war there between those who want to join the European Union, not tomorrow, but yesterday, if possible, versus those who say, listen, part of this country has always been under Russian and Soviet influence, originally Russian influence now, and we can't do with not having our economy linked to the way that the Russian economy is moving. Now, it just happens that at this point in time, the Russian economy is not doing so badly at all. It's not doing so badly at all. Whilst putting our hands to our to our conscience, we do know that we have a lot of problems in the European Union at the moment. So they will say, "Heck, to hell with the European Union! Let's better the devil you know." Mm. And economics does not exist in a vacuum.
Mm. In many countries in Ukraine that owe their existence to the purchasing power of Russia.
Of course. And another thing, of course, is that very often in a very important part of international economics, which is international trading relations, importation, exportation, many theorists hold that in reality, this is a zero-sum game, in the sense that if I'm exporting a lot to you, and you're buying a lot from me, well, I'm taking a lot out of your resources. So I'm gaining and you're losing. It's a run to the bottom, if you see what I mean, in the case of some countries. And widening the discourse, this run to the bottom in the context of certain parts of the world, let's call them, just generally speaking, the poor parts of the world, Africa and South America, they've been down there for a long time. Is it fair on them, and I would add also on the rest of the world, that they should remain down there? I don't think so. So
it's no problem getting them out of it.
We have to. We owe it.
The other subject which you teach is economics of sport.
Yes.
And I rushed to the internet to see what I could find out about it. And I found that there's actually a journal
of sports economics, so it's become
quite a discipline nowadays.
I think what might interest you is how on earth this subject actually got into the university at all in the first place. It's funny, the former head of the institute down there, which originally was part of the Faculty of Education, but one day the former head, the late Michael Aquilina, and myself, we were sitting on a committee celebrating, preparing the celebrations for Birkir Kara Football Club, which I support, the first championship. We were around, and I offhandedly said to Michael, listen, I said, in the various British universities, there's this subject which is growing, there's a lot of literature coming out. I wonder whether any of your students doing your PE courses and your degrees are giving any insights into this area of the life into which they eventually will be moving out into. He said, no, we don't. He said, you write up the course for me and we'll get it in. And I wrote up the course and I started, and it caught on excellent. There's a lot of interest from those who are now there in it. Now, why economics of sport? Very simple answer. Because today sport is yet another competitor, amongst many things in life, for people's life and interests. And purses. And purses. And sports today is an industry. Sports today is an industry. One, what makes the headlines very often are the big sums of money paid for buying of players, or whether Manchester United are now, for example, take Manchester United at this point in time, are going through a very bad patch. And the questions which are already being asked are whether their business model up to now, which is basically based on their success story. If you're successful, people will want to invest in you.
Buy your merchandise.
Merchandise. People want to have their names on your playing shirts and what have you. But when you start losing, will the attraction remain the same?
The audience is rather fickle.
Exactly. And a lot of literature about it, as I said, and things are now in that area. We measure, for example, demand for a sport. Here again, you know, demand for a sport is slightly different to demand as we generally speak of it elsewhere in economics. Why? Because this is, I mean, if I'm turning up at the turnstile and I pay €5, €10 to watch a football game, the outcome of what I'm getting for my €10 is totally unknown. I may be going there to spend good money, and when you see some of the price tags to watch football games abroad, I mean, they're very high. I think it costs about £75 sterling to watch an Arsenal Football Club match nowadays. That's a lot of money. And so you're going there and you're buying a product, but you don't really know
the outcome or the quality.
Or the quality. It may be a game which ends up 0-0, but the quality of the football could have been excellent. So your afternoon and the money would have been well worthwhile. So that's one particular aspect of the characteristic of demand for the sport. Secondly, is whether that demand is nationally shared. I mean, the more you say football and everybody, oh, yes, football, you know, and boys and even girls now want to play football. But it's not like that everywhere. It's not like that everywhere. In many countries, it's not football. It's ice hockey or baseball or basketball. So there are studies which measure this demand. The same thing is something which we do have elsewhere in economics is, for example, return on investment. I mean, if a government votes to spend 1 million on, improving an already existing national stadium, as opposed to spending that same 1 million on a local nursery football ground. Where's the return going to come from? How fast? There are ways and means of measuring that. So, again, it's a fascinating discipline. Mm-hmm. And
in Malta, yeah, sports tourism as well, of course.
Sports tourism. There is for, you take,
popular idea.
I mean, sports tourism is immensely important. But now we keep speaking a lot about sports tourism in Malta. We're also speaking about things like agritourism and things like that. But anyway, we're not inventing the wheel. Let's be clear about this. I mean, Australia, for example, is the country where in practically every year, somewhere in Australia, there is a competition of world level, which is attracting tourists from outside. So it might be the Australian Open, it might be the World Swimming Championships, it might be the World Athletic Championships, it might be the Commonwealth Games. And the Australians are very good. The government is. The government is. The various state governments also are in planning and being active on the international markets to convince these international federations to decide to have that competition, do it there. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of sports tourism going in Australia. Now, other countries are also latching up on this. I suspect the South Americans are going, I mean, for me, it was an important indicator that Brazil managed to get both the World Cup and then the Olympics very soon after. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that the Brazilian economists and planners are already thinking about what after the Olympic Games. And this thing, careers, you know.
Well, unfortunately, we've come to the end of our time.
Oh,
Dr. Jean Quintilio, thank you so much for coming
you.
To talk to us
thank
on
you,
this
thank
subject
thank you.
Today.
Thank you for listening to University Matters on Campus FM. I hope you'll join us again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.
Il-programm li għadkom kem smajtu kien miġju plilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.